Okay, I think we should start. My feeling is that more or less we are starting to lose half of the population, which in some sense I would have to say it's a pity, but in another sense it's not too uncommon. Because, okay, if it gets apparent to everyone that you have to have some basic mathematical knowledge, then some people just disappear. Okay, fact of life. But we can't do without it. So, what is the plan for today? I am here until, let's say, 10:50, and I will continue with the lecture. Then we have some kind of negotiation with a new professor we want to hire. So I have to be present there as dean of the faculty. So Benjamin Kellermann will continue. And he asked that I leave the exercises to him because he had the feeling, hey, if I'm giving the lecture, then I have to understand what Andreas did put on his slides. And okay, it's always hard to do a lecture if you haven't made the slides yourself. And when I was in your position, I was studying computer science at Karlsruhe University. Sometimes a professor working with that kind of projector put on a slide, did read it, and then said, "Oh, what did my scientific stuff put on that slide? I don't understand it, or it's wrong." And usually this is not the best way to motivate student. Okay, some then get very curious. Okay, so if you only want to get them curious, then maybe it's very motivating that you stand there and say, "Hey, I don't understand it." But okay, not the best attitude. So I will continue with the lecture, and then Benjamin Kellermann will do the exercises with you. And I hope those who are here have prepared the exercises and have understood that, okay, some mathematics has to be mastered. Okay, this was the last slide. So maybe we go a little bit back. What we had is, I gave you a short intro into random bitstream generators, pseudo-random bitstream generators. Hopefully you understood that if they exist, then they are a really useful tool. Really useful in the sense that you have a short random input, so the real random number here, and the generator gives you a long bitstream, which is pseudo-random. And security then means that the attacker, the adversary, can't make a distinction between a long random bitstream and a long pseudo-random bitstream. And if you cannot make a distinction, then obviously pseudo-random is as good as random against that kind of attacker. So if this exists, it would be a kind of amplifier for randomness. And you know, in different kinds of branches of engineering, that having some kind of amplifier usually is a good thing. I presented to you a particular pseudo-random generator, the so-called square mod n generator. The name more or less gives you all the information you need. You are squaring, 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 squaring. Okay, square mod n generator. This squaring, 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 squaring mod n, of course, gives you a sequence of pseudo-random numbers, or sometimes I will call it internal states of the generator. And if you want to have a bit string, then somehow you have to transform random numbers or internal states into bits. And one way to do that is just do a calculation mod 2, meaning you're taking the last bit. Okay. The interesting part of the generator is, first, you can run it forward. You have squaring, 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 and so on and so forth. Pretty clear if you do it long enough, since it's a finite state automaton, somehow it will start cycling. Just because if you're considering numbers mod n, there are, if n is large, there are very, very many numbers, but not infinitely many. So somehow it will start cycling. Because if you start in the same state, or you re-enter the same state you had before, from then on, cycling. In the number of internal states, and of course, cycling in the number of pseudo-random bits. We noted that, of course, a necessary condition for security is that the cycles are long enough. Or more precisely, that nearly all cycles are long enough. So the probability that you hit a cycle which is relatively short is so small that we can ignore it. This surely is a necessary condition. Because if this condition is not met, then pretty clear, you look and you guess whether a cycle occurs. And if you find one, then you can, of course, make a distinction between random and pseudo-random. For a random string, no cycling. Of course, you can have some kind of cycles in your random string, but you will not have cycling to appear in a systematic fashion. Okay? So far, I would say everything I told you is usual stuff about pseudo-random generators. They have a finite state. Sooner or later, they are going to cycle, and the cycle length has to be large enough. Okay. And now it gets very special, because the S square mod n generator has a particular property. You cannot only calculate the internal states forward, you can also calculate them backward. Because we did choose P and Q to be congruent 3 mod 4. And if we know P and Q, it's pretty clear how to calculate roots. So here we have the particular situation. You cannot only do it forward, you can do it backward as well. This surely is a requirement a normal pseudo-random generator has not to meet, because this is just an additional property. Of course, in some sense, this makes the S square mod n generator particularly interesting, because some applications will work if you can only go forward. For example, if you use a pseudo-random generator for emulating the one-time pad, then just being able to go forward is all you need. But maybe being able to go backward gives you some applications you wouldn't have without it. So we can take roots, And if you do the exercises with respect to the generator, you will in particularly learn that you can take roots and roots and roots and roots. Why? If you have a square, you can take a root. And if you take the usual algorithm, how to do roots, the result, again, will be a square. So you can continue doing roots. So you can go backwards. And to say it frankly, you can go further backward than you ever went forward. Pretty clear. If you can go backwards forever, and if you only did go a finite number of steps forward, then surely you can go further backward than you ever went forward. It works. Of course, if you continue going backwards, the internal state you then generate will have nothing to do with what, for example, the other party generating the sequence ever did. Pretty clear. So what kind of guarantee do you have? You would like to have that if the other party goes m steps forward, generating the corresponding bits, and if you go maybe m or even more steps backward, then you would require that at least the first m bits you get are the bits which have been originally generated. Of course, if you go further backwards, no chance, no relationship to anything. So let's see, what does this mean? It means that even the first bit we take has to be a square. Well, the first pseudo-random number we take in generating the sequence has to be a square. Otherwise, in going backward, because we always will take the square, and in the exercise you will also prove that only one of the four squares itself is a square, so it's unique. So in going backward, you really take the square. And this is the right number to choose out of the four roots. And this gives us the cause why we have this first step. We take an S, being element of Zn star, and at the moment we haven't any clue whether this is a square or not. To start generating the bits, if we ever want to go backwards, we have to make sure that the first internal state where we take a bit is a square. So what do? You take your S and you square it. Then you know it's a square. Easiest procedure. And only then you take a bit. So we don't take, for generating the bits, S. We only take S0 until SI. So the last bit of S is not taken. Only then we can go backwards. It's a very interesting thing, and I think I didn't make it part of the exercise, that you start thinking about, if you are sure that you are only going forward, do you need that step? Can you do without it? And if you can do without it, gets it more insecure if you omit that step, gets it more secure if you omit that step, or does omitting that step change nothing with respect to security? Interesting question. Maybe you should think about it. Would be a splendid good question in an oral examination if I have the feeling that you have really understood what you are talking about. If it's only whether you pass, then surely this question will be too difficult. Okay, this was SQL-mod engine. So this was the SQL-mod end generator as the pseudo one-time pad. And what is much more important is the general construction, the general kind of security argument. How can we argue that the pseudo random one-time pad is as secure as the pseudorandom generator? And the proof is pretty straightforward. If it's not secure, the pseudo one-time pad, but we know that the one-time pad is secure, we did prove that, then if an attacker can detect the insecurity of the pseudo one-time pad, that attacker can make a distinction whether the construction of the one-time pad takes random numbers, or random bits, or pseudo-random numbers, or pseudo-random bit sequences. And of course, if he can make a distinction, he breaks the security of the generator, because he can make a distinction between random and pseudo-random. And therefore, the idea of this proof is very, very general. And the result is, whenever you take a construction which is information theoretically secure, you can replace real randomness by pseudo randomness, at the sole risk that if your generator is insecure, then of course your construction breaks. But if the generator is secure, this kind of argument tells you your construction is secure, which is really a very powerful statement, because it tells you that you may combine two things and you know something about the combination. Usually, if you think about software engineering, if you think about composing systems, you know that many properties of systems are not maintained if you compose. And usually you can't tell anything about that. Here, we know something. And the argument is very straightforward. So hopefully you're also able to convince others. On this slide, we start using the capability of going backwards, because we are transmitting the internal state to the decrypting party. You see, we are publishing the modulus n. We are keeping secret the primes, which are congruent 3 mod 4, p and q. It's pretty clear that this kind of using the SQL mod n generator as an asymmetric system is a system encrypting probabilistically. It's doing probabilistic encryption, because when you encrypt the plaintext twice, you will use a different random initial value, a different seed. So the two encryptions of your plaintext will look completely different. And therefore, it's probabilistic encryption. So if you think back, when I gave you an introduction to asymmetric encryption, I mentioned if it shall be really secure, even for plain text, which have only little entropy, then encryption has to be probabilistic. And here we have it, in a quite natural way. The seed is chosen randomly, and for each message, you're choosing a new seed. Okay. The decryptor then takes the internal state, more precisely, the internal state squared once more, and starts calculating backwards and gets the bit sequence in reverse order. Can of course subtract the bits. Okay, my two addition and subtraction is the same, and gets the plaintext bits. So you see, it works. So far, the good news. And now in some sense comes the bad news. And the bad news is, hey, active attacks are a problem. Just to rethink what was active attacks. Active attacks was that the party having a kind of secret key, be it in a symmetric setting, a party having the symmetric key, or in an asymmetric setting, the party having the secret key. That party does operations, the attacker chooses, the attacker specifies, or the attacker triggers. Different way to express the same thing. So the problem here is that an attacker, who of course taps this line, gets to know this internal state. And of course, by just squaring, he can generate succeeding internal states, which is one of the reasons that we couldn't say you choose one initial random value and then you use it for as many messages as you like. Because all messages except the first one, of course, would be completely insecure because an attacker would tap the line and could just continue the squaring, right? So for the second message, surely we need a new random seed. Otherwise, it's pretty obvious how you break it, okay? So now we start getting a feeling that there might be a problem. At least I hope you got a feeling. And of course, now we can discuss endlessly different kinds of attacks. One way to start with an attack I did describe here. I just said most simple version, the attacker just squares once more. He just adds one bit, can be a one or a zero, I don't care. And if the attacked party is stupid enough to decrypt that and to output it, the attacker gets to learn the plain text plus appended a random bit. So in this very simple attack, the attacker just would get to learn the plain text of another message, because here he changed the message. So far, I would assume everybody understood it. And now, of course, we can discuss how reasonable is it that an attacker who once got a message is going to decrypt another message which is pretty close to a message he once got. And now you could argue, hey, if the attacked party is attentive to active attacks, the attack party never ever should decrypt two very closely related messages. And in particular, it shouldn't output any of the two decryption results. Therefore, in the next step, we have in some sense to generalize this kind of attack. And we can do it in two ways. The first modification is, of course, we can here change the message. Just input some bits you choose as the attacker. Then, of course, the plaintext you will get usually won't make sense. But this is a good thing, because usually if you're attacking people, if you're asking them to return bit strings to you, the less sense those bit strings make, the more probable that the bit string will be returned to you. If someone sends you something and you start recognizing, hey, this was a love letter I got from my girlfriend yesterday, then probably you won't return the plain text to the attacker. Would you? I wouldn't. But if it's just pretty close to a random noise, maybe I'll return it. In particular, I will return it if the attacker gives me the impression that returning that to him will somehow be helpful to me. Maybe he helps me or pretends to help me in debugging my software, whatever. Think about different kinds of cover stories. So this is the first modification. We replace those bits here. We get completely different bits here. But, of course, we can do the difference between the bits here and the bits here. And these differences, those are the bits generated, the pseudo-random bits generated. This is the sequence you need to decrypt the original message. So somehow we generalized the attack slightly. Okay? And now, of course, we can do a second step. This was just squaring it once. Okay. If this would be the only way to attack it, then of course, after receiving a message, you would square it once, store the result, and whenever another message comes, checking whether the internal state transmitted is one of the internal state you once generated by squaring. But of course, an attacker can square once, twice, three times, as many times as he likes. Now you see, checking for all those possibilities gets at least time consuming. I wouldn't argue that it's absolutely impossible to do it, but it gets time consuming, very time consuming. And therefore, just checking for that probably isn't a really good idea. So what would we do in practice? And this now again is very general, and more or less it has nothing to do with the SQMUT and generator in particular. What was the problem? At a very high level, the problem was that the attacker could take ciphertext he once tapped modify it a little bit, or even modify it to a larger extent, and submit the modified ciphertext. And this modified ciphertext is a ciphertext which is completely okay, which can be decrypted. So, of course, if you want to counter that kind of active attack, what would you do? You would say, hey, I would define the message format here such that if an attacker is changing a single bit, then the probability that it's a message which can be decrypted without raising suspicion gets negligibly small. So in some sense, you would start using some kind of authentication. So this was only secrecy. And still I maintain the sole purpose of what we just want to achieve is secrecy. But to counter active attack, combining that with some kind of authentication may be a splendid good idea. At least it's a much better idea than for each internal value you once got, you are generating the square, the first one, the second one, the third one, maybe 1 billion further squarings. Okay, you see. So far we got last week. Any questions? I hope explaining it a second time was helpful. So do you have any questions, any discussions? Of course, if I present it a second time, I more or less only give you the main arguments, the bold lines, not all details. Any questions? Yes, usually it would be the length of the prime numbers. Yes. So it could be 1,000. And then if P and Q have length of 1,000 bits, this would mean that N has a length of 2,000 bits. And given today's technology, I would say for the next years, this is secure enough. Secure enough if the attack is factoring the modulus. Maybe if you do some protocol problems or if you're using insecure system, okay, but for factoring 2000 bit is pretty okay. Of course, if you think, and this is one of the exercises, about medical data, how long do you think that medical data has to be kept secret? Okay, so 80 years, 100 years? Okay. So first, let's assume it's 80 years. First statement to be made is nobody, really nobody on Earth has experience keeping a secret for 80 years. Nobody has. And this is particularly true for computers. The military is absolutely happy if they manage to keep secrets for 30 years. 80 years, well beyond the horizon. First statement. Second statement, are you sure that 100 years is enough? And please don't mention that there are some people who reach the age of 110. Okay, are you sure that 130 is large enough? I would say no. Because if people have children, usually some illnesses are depending on the genome, which usually is given to the children, at least half of it. So, regrettably, if we really take data protection and keeping the autonomy and privacy of persons serious with respect to medical privacy, there, for most data, or at least for many data, there is no limit how long we have to keep it secret. And now you see, okay, now it gets very, very shocking. And again, what was a very good choice, and I would say a very safe choice, choosing L to be 1,000, probably for the medical field, not enough, by far not enough. Of course, now you could argue, hey, if it has to be kept secret forever, then no fixed L will ever do. So we, in some sense, then have to go to information theoretically secure, ruling out all the asymmetric cryptography. And when I then listen to politicians and some providers of the German health card who tell you, hey, we really thought about security, everything is fine, please trust us, I can only start laughing. Okay, it was just an argument, a very simple argument. I think you can explain it to your parents. It's ridiculous. Okay. Nice. If you convince the bad guys that they do it as well and don't keep a copy of the data they had before, then it works very fine. But then I would say, why do we do encryption at all? We should convince the bad guys not to misuse information. Very simple. Let's make sure everybody goes to church at least once a week, and that the priest tells you something about privacy, and the problem is solved. Okay. I don't want to put in doubt that if we would agree to that rule, that some people, maybe even many people, would play according to the rules. But security is making sure that it works even if some people don't play according to the rules. You see? By the way, in the exercises, you will have an exercise where I ask you, hey, if key size gets too small, public key size, how about a difference, or is there a difference between asymmetric cryptography for encryption and asymmetric cryptography for digital signatures? For encryption, we just learned it doesn't work well. Any idea what to do with respect to digital signatures? Does it work well there? And there, the answer is yes. You can make it work there. You can say, whenever you got a signature which is getting insecure over the next 10 years, let's assume, what can you do? You go to a timestamping service and let your signature timestamps. So therefore, you can later prove that you had it long before the system got breakable. This works fine. For digital signatures, there's a clear solution, and I'm very happy that we have it. But we haven't any solution for confidentiality. And I would argue there isn't any solution. And therefore, my feeling is, this is now a statement as a citizen, that usually I value confidentiality and privacy higher than I value integrity and availability with respect to doing research. Of course, if I'm in the medical field, probably integrity and availability is much more important for me than privacy, because after all, I want to survive the treatment in the hospital. In some sense, I would say this is even more basic than protecting your privacy. But to be frankly, I don't believe that if you go high tech, if data is stored in many places, that you can keep privacy for, let's say, longer than 30 years. And if you go to some kind of open system that everybody can attach any kind of computer, install any kind of operating system to handle your data. And this mainly is the case how the system shall work. Then I would say you won't protect privacy longer than a few weeks, to be realistic. But okay. So to sum up, when we are talking about asymmetric encryption, we have to start with a security parameter which is chosen very, very well, because there's no way later to limit damage in a reasonable way. So I would say be very careful there. If it's about digital signatures, you can take much larger risks, because if, let's say, performance is not okay, because if you take it so long, then doing a digital signature takes you half an hour, which surely is not really a good idea if you want to, let's say, do a digital signature just to get money from your bank. Standing in your bank half an hour, waiting until your digital signature is calculated, probably you wouldn't enjoy that. And by the way, the bank wouldn't enjoy it either, because of course they say they like their customers, but having too many of their customers in the bank is something they probably don't like. So, okay, if this would ever be the case, you could make it smaller and could say, if it proves out that you made it too small in the midterm, you can later on improve it. Okay, this was one of the exercises, and I think it's really important when you design a system that you know that whether you can improve it later on or not with respect to the data your system processed. I think this is very fundamental, and usually it's not discussed, because it makes life more difficult. And most people don't like any discussion if they have the feeling the discussion could make their life more difficult. Okay, sounds somehow familiar. Okay, any more questions? Yes.
Would you please just give a short generalization of this, of your approach of solving this thing?
Okay. If you said signing, then I assume you're discussing the asymmetric case. What did you want to say, authenticating? If I speak about signing, it means asymmetric. If I talk about authentication, can be symmetric or asymmetric. So what is your question?
I would say authentication.
Okay. Then I would say I have no general rule. It depends whether it's symmetric or asymmetric, solution or the answer. Let's assume it's symmetric, first case. Then I would say encryption first, and then authentication. Why? Because authentication, symmetric authentication, doesn't mean anything for anybody else. Therefore, the party checking the authentication will usually be the party knowing the decryption key. So I would go there for efficiency. And efficiency means by encryption, the data doesn't get longer. By authentication, it gets. So we are saving some encryption expense if you're doing it in that order. Secondly, your encryption system, in case it could be broken somehow, if you know something about the redundancy of your encrypted text. Hopefully it can't be broken, but the usual way trying to break systems is having some kind of redundancy. For example, the probabilities of plain text characters, things like that. So this was the starting point for classical cryptanalysis. Now, if you are encrypting authenticated text, this kind of authenticator is some kind of redundancy. Therefore, if you authenticate first and later on encrypt, it's not only longer what you have to encrypt, but it contains more redundancy, which usually is a bad idea. Therefore, in the symmetric case, the rule, the conclusion for me is first encryption, then authentication. In an asymmetric setting, I would argue that the usual purpose of the digital signature is that you can prove something to a third person. And now if you do encryption first and then digital signatures, you could prove to a third person that you got a ciphertext. But usually what you want to prove in real life is what the meaning of the ciphertext is. So you would have to take additional precautions to be able to prove what the plain text was, because otherwise the digital signature is meaningless. Now we could start a long discussion what to do to be able to prove what the meaning of a ciphertext is. Could be an interesting discussion, but if we want to go the straight way, I would say you sign the plain text. Then your communication partner gets the signature under the contract, for example, being the plain text, contract being the plain text. And if you need confidentiality, then you encrypt contract, plain text, and signature. So with asymmetric cryptography, I would do it in the different way. First, digital signature, then encryption. So this is a conclusion of this kind of exercise. Okay, any more questions? Okay, in some sense, okay, you all know the buzzword of social engineering. This doesn't mean Facebook, right? Social engineering means you are calling people, you are talking with them, you are friendly to them, Maybe you know something about them. Here, Facebook might help a lot. And you give them the feeling that if they tell you something, it's a good thing. For example, many emails trying to do some phishing work that way. We have found a security problem. Please send us your PIN, then you will be able to help you. Nice argument, right? In the meantime, the credibility of that kind of emails, hopefully, isn't too high to most people. But still, it seems to work with some people. Otherwise, those messages would disappear because it would be completely useless to send that. Obviously, this is not the case. So, what is the lesson to learn? If someone has a splendid, good idea for social engineering, which is completely new and fully striking, fully convincing, then you will achieve everything. Whatever you are enabled to do with your system, sending plain text, sending information, moving money from here to there, whatever you can do, if social engineering is successful with respect to you, you can do what you can do for your own disadvantage. This is the backside of freedom. If you are free to do it, and if you don't understand what you do, you don't appreciate the context in which you do it, then freedom has a dark side. The conclusions, of course, now which people take are quite different. Some people would say, hey, because freedom has a dark side, let's eliminate freedom. Sometimes in the Ministry of the Interior, I have the feeling many guys think along those lines. Their motivation surely is a good one. They want to protect citizens. But what remains from your citizenship if your freedom is taken away? I would argue not much. And as some people say, ever life has been risky. So trying to eliminate all kinds of risk in real life, no good idea. Therefore, I would say take another approach. Start convincing or start teaching people what they might expect. What kind of reward you usually get for what kind of action. If I meet you on the street and I tell you, hey, if you give me an interview, I'm giving you 10 euros, then maybe this is a realistic thing, because depending on the information I get in the interview, maybe it's worth 10 euros. Okay. If I go through the streets and I just say, hey, here is a 10 euro banknote, I just want to give it to you, then usually you would start getting somehow suspicious. At least I would hope so. Is this really a 10 euro note? Is this a fake? What's going to happen here? I don't say that there's a very easy answer how you should behave. There are different ways you can behave. You could just say, hey, this is too surprising for me, I don't take it. You could take it, go straight away to the next bank and say, hey, I just got a present by someone, I don't know the person. Please could you check whether this is really a 10 euro banknote or some kind of fake? If it's really a 10 euro banknote, then it's good for me. If it's a fake, then please put it out of service. Different ways to do it. If someone meets you on the street and say, hey, I have this small parcel, I just want to bring that parcel from here to a few kilometers. And I'm going to pay you €1,000 for that. Then hopefully you would get very suspicious. So, after all, I would say, coming back now to cryptography, if by social engineering we can get people in a position to decrypt ciphertexts the attacker is interested in, cryptography, encryption won't help. If you can do it, if you do it. And pretty clear, you can do it. Because if I would argue, let's use encryption in a way that the recipient can't decrypt, then you would say, oh, no, it's crazy. Now it gets paranoid. Now it has lost any contact to reality. So you can do it. So the interesting question is, you can encrypt. You can see it, usually if it's email, on your screen. Should we implement a system that what you see on your screen is something you can't send further? Some people would argue that way. In a company, if you get an email, why should you be able to forward your email? Okay, then let's assume we try to hinder that. So what would you do? You would start typing the email you got into another email, which you then could send. So should we make your computer monitor what you do? And if you are started typing, at least after two sentences, your computer gives you an alarm and says, hey, you are just typing word by word another email. You shouldn't do that. Now you get more clever. Humans usually get more clever. Oh, after you got that message a few times, you say, hey, I do it slightly different. I'm not typing it word by word. Just make some changes. Now you would need algorithms here, being able to measure semantic equivalence or semantic closeness of statements. And now you see we are pretty close to some harder artificial intelligence problems. Should we try to implement that? Okay. Now probably next iteration would be, hey, as long as you see some email, your keyboard is locked. You are not able to type anything. Splendid, good idea. I really would love a computer who works that way. And probably my next idea would be, hey, I need a second computer. Great. Okay, now you could try to make the computer synchronize using Bluetooth. Okay. Then probably I would have the idea saying, hey, I have a mobile phone. This mobile phone has a camera, so I can make a JPEG out of the email. Okay, now if they are really after that kind of problem, then of course my mobile phone should synchronize with all my computers. Bad luck. But I could ask a colleague, could you please make a JPEG out of this email? Because I can't, because my mobile phone doesn't do. So you see, okay, I could continue for that for quite a while. So to be frank, I hope we can build systems in a way and design interfaces of secure systems such that they are not misleading the user. But I don't see a way that if the user wants to do something with the information he's entitled to see, prevent the use of gratitude. Therefore, now I come back to the definition of active attack. Usually, in cryptography, we completely ignore the situation that an active attack is just done by submitting the ciphertext and getting the plaintext. Because we assume that way you can break any system. And in some sense, technically, I don't believe that we can do much against that. Therefore, cryptographers define active attacks such that you send something which may be related to something which has been sent before, but which is not a bit-by-bit copy. So this is a way to get as close as possible. The bit-by-bit copy, no way to prevent it. But what is the next best to achieve, even if you change one bit, it shouldn't work. This was the argument I gave. And probably my long story hopefully helps you to learn two things. First, freedom has a downside. And I would say this is something we should accept and we should take responsibility for. This was the message to the citizens. And secondly, cryptographers, in their definition of active attack, got as close to protecting the attacked person as is possible. You can't protect someone against something he really wants. You can always shoot into your own head if you like. Okay. Any more questions? Because I would hope, let's say, in some sense, the last 10 minutes have been small talk. Compared with mathematics, yes, it has been small talk. On the other hand, I think the points I wanted to make are really, really important. Because the tension between freedom and safety is really a tension. It won't go away. So we have to communicate that to any person, to any citizen, to any politician. First statement. Second statement, of course, in building IT systems, we should protect people whenever we can really protect them. I can't protect you against something you really want. But I could try to build a system such that it's something you don't want, then it's not going to happen. So it still may be hard, but it may be achievable. Whereas protecting you against something you explicitly want, I would say, okay, no. I even won't try. Okay. I told you a lot about the square mod n generator, and you remember in the lecture I started with the secure systems. Maybe I should go back. We had this famous slide where I said we start with the most secure systems, with the Wurm cipher and the authentication codes. And then we are talking about cryptographically strong systems. And cryptographically strong systems are systems where we can prove their security under an assumption. We cannot prove it straight from scratch. This is only something we can at the moment do for information theoretic security. But here, we can do some proof. under some assumption. And this proof is outstanding, so we have to do it. So let's do it. I mentioned that a PBG, a pseudo-random bitstream generator, should output pseudo-random sequences which look completely random. This is a very, very strong definition. And in some sense, it's hard to operationalize. What does it mean that something looks pretty random? If you meet in smaller groups, try to formalize what means looks pretty random. And I would say, give yourself a break after half day of work and then start reading the literature, because it will take you months to arrive at a good definition. Historically, it has taken decades to arrive at good definitions what it means looks random. It's not easy. But give it a try, because you only will experience that it is difficult if you try it yourself. If it looks completely random, then surely some more precise formulations have to hold. For example, let's assume this is the sequence of bits generated. So B0 until BK. Then if you give me the sequence except the first element, so you give me B1, B2, BK, it should be impossible for me to guess with a probability significantly larger than 1/2 what the first bit was. This means unpredictability to the left. Of course, you could define the same thing to the right. So if you would ask me, I give you this sequence, please tell me what is BK plus 1? This would be unpredictability to the right. And again, of course, we would argue, hey, if it's random, if it looks random, you shouldn't have a possibility to do a prediction with a success rate of essentially better than 1/2. And of course, you could generalize it. If you go from 1 bit to 2 bits, then okay, then it's 1/4. Not essentially better than 1/4 to do the prediction, to the left, to the right. Then of course, you can say, oh, hey, how about bits in the middle? Have a start of the sequence, the tail of the sequence. Could I predict the bits in the middle? And again, shouldn't be able to do that. And now just a statement which is somehow tricky to prove, so I won't prove it here, but if you read the literature, you will find proofs there. All the three definitions, unpredictability to the left, unpredictability to the right, and unpredictability in the middle, all these definitions are equivalent. And all these definitions are equivalent to looks completely random. Proving these equivalences is really tricky. Okay. So what we just now take is we take as our formulation for security, unpredictability to the left. I just choose that. I had the option of the others, but I choose this. Or Bloom, and Sharp took that. It's not my proof, it's their proof. So this is a PPG, this is a predictor, this predictor gets n, this is the same n, then that's n. And the predictor outputs a b, a bit. And the predictor is really good if this b equals b0 in essentially more than half the cases. Okay, so formalizing that, the S square mod n generator is cryptographically strong if and only if, for all predictors p, and the predictors are polynomial probabilistic algorithms, PPA, polynomial probabilistic algorithms. For all constants delta, and delta is in between 0 and 1, so this is somehow the frequency of the bad n's, so there may be a very small fraction of n's, which is not really nice. For all t's, being a natural number, this is the degree of the polynomial. We have if the security parameter, usually the length of n, is sufficiently big, we have for all keys n except of the of at most a delta fraction, we have the probability that the predictor on input of n b1 until bk, so b1 until bk, outputs b0, that is outputs the right bit, predicts the correct bit to the left. This probability is smaller than 1/2 plus something which is really small, and really small in our formalization means L to the power of t, 1 divided by L to the power of t. So it gets towards 1/2 as fast as 1 divided by any polynomial. So this is a precise formulation what we have to prove. And we do this proof in two steps. So if we prove something, of course, if it's about cryptographically strong, I have first to say, on what assumption do I do the proof? Because I have to assume something. And the assumption here is the quadratic reciprocity assumption. That is, it's not easy to make a distinction whether a number which has Jacobi symbol 1 is a quadratic residue or not. So maybe I should go back. So this was a QRA, the quadratic reciprocity assumption. So it had Jacobi symbol 1. And determining whether X is a quadratic residue, even if we know it has Jacobi symbol 1, is hard. Can it be done better than plain guessing? Okay, so this is what we want to prove. So how do we do such a kind of proof? What we really want to do is we want to prove security. And the trick to do the proof is we assume it's insecure, and we are concluding that if the generator is insecure, then the quadratic reciprocity assumption, then the assumption we usually do, is wrong. So it's an indirect proof. So what do we want to do? The S square mod n generator is weak. This is what we assume. That is, there is a predictor which guesses this bit to the left with an epsilon advantage given the rest of the bit stream. If you can prove that, then, or if we assume that, and we can do a proof that now the quadratic reciprocity assumption is false, we have done what we want to do. This proof will be done. It does correct guessing with 1/2 plus epsilon, epsilon being a fixed number larger than zero. So the usual thing you know in analysis, so okay. But good question. Maybe I should have said that. So it's guessing it with a fixed probability larger than one, which contradicts this, because whenever it's really larger than one, you can determine a value of LNT that it gets closer to 1/2, and okay. So step one, we will transform the predictor P in some kind predictor P star, such that P star gives to a given S1, now it's not about the bits but the internal states, which is a quadratic residue. This predictor P star guesses the last bit of S0 with an epsilon advantage. So this is the first step we want to do. The second step will then be, if we have P star, so construct using P star a method R that guesses with an epsilon advantage whether a given S star with the Jacobi symbol plus 1 is a square. So first we are going to construct P star, and then in step 2, on the basis that we have that constructed, we'll construct a procedure R which breaks the quadratic residuosity assumption. So step 1, given we have an S1 mentioned here. So if we have a S1, what can we do? We just take the generator. We generate S2, S3, and so on. So we just generate a bit sequence, B1, B2, B3, with the S square mod n generator. So we apply our P. P is what we have according to our assumption. We assumed the generator is weak, therefore we have a P. So we apply P to that stream, and P guesses V0, that is continuation to the left, with an epsilon advantage. Okay, this is exactly P star. What do we have? We transform the predictor to the left in a procedure P star, which to a given S1 guesses the last bit of S0. Okay, this is just what we did. Now step 2. We want to construct a method R using P star, which breaks the quadratic residuosity assumption. So given, now we do it, given we have an S star. This is this S star here, right? Then we calculate an S1 by just squaring S star. Okay. Now we apply P star, this is what we generated in step 1. We apply P star to S1. P star guesses the last bit of S0 with an epsilon advantage, according to what we had in step 1, where S star and S0 are roots of S1. So here at the moment, we don't know whether S star is a square or not. But we are using P star, and P star guesses the last bit of S0. with an epsilon advantage. This is what we had here. And now, what do we have? We want to have a method R that guesses with an epsilon advantage whether a given S star, the Jacobi symbol plus one, is a square. So we have S star, and we get the last bit of S0. And now, we'll just see it on the next slide. The good thing is that we have a simple test how this answer of the last bit of S0 can be transformed in an answer whether S star is a square. And it's very simple. S star is a square. It's element of the quadratic residues Moren if and only if S star is S0, that is, as we shall see, the last bits are equal. So first here, this statement here on this slide, it's pretty clear because of the four roots, only one is a quadratic residue. This I mentioned very often. You have to prove that in the corresponding exercise. So if S0 and S star are equal, then S star is a quadratic residue. Otherwise, it's not. And now it's important to prove that knowing the last bit is enough to make the distinction whether they are the same or not. Okay, let's see. The last bit, B star of S star, and the guessed bit, B0 of S0, are enough to guess correctly. Because if S star and S0 are the same, then clearly the last bit is the same. This was easy. And now we have to show that if they are different, then the last bits are different. Then we have it. So if S star and S0 are not the same, but we know they have the same Jacobi symbol, then what do we know? If they have the same Jacobi symbol, they are minus one. So you can say S star is congruent to minus S0 mod n because they have the same Jacobi symbol. And now we know n being the product of two large primes is odd, right? Because large primes are not even, right? So their product is not even as well. So this congruence can be transformed that S is n minus S0 in the integers. And since n is odd, therefore S star and S0 have different last bits. That's it. This was the last part of this step two. And therefore, we have constructed an algorithm R, which is in contradiction to the quadratic residue assumption. Any questions? I would say yes, but in some sense they are subroutines, so they can be made equal. But in some sense, this step gives us some kind of subroutine, some kind of algorithm. This gives us some kind of subroutine, some algorithm. And if you really want to break a concrete systems, we could equal them. Okay, what we have here in step one is a procedure telling us if we have an S1 which is a square, we can guess the last bit of S0 with an epsilon advantage. Here, we start with an S star, and then we square it, and this makes sure that the result is a square. And therefore, then we know this value here has the properties required there. And therefore, we can use the subroutine of step one. Now it's clear? So this step one, in some sense, is some kind of programming. We are just generating a subroutine. And the concrete values start here in step two. And then we will call step one as a subroutine out of step two, binding the value of S1. Okay? Any more questions? Then two remarks, and then I finish and we'll have your break. The first remark is, in the description of the S2 mod n generator, I always mentioned you can take the last bit. And of course, a quite natural question is, why can I only take the last bit? Could I take the two last bit, the three last bits? How many bits could I take? And asymptotically, one can argue that if you take logarithmically many bits in L, it's still secure, which means in each step, you're not just taking one bit, but logarithmically many in L. Giving an example, let's assume L has a value of 1,000. This was the example we started with. Let's assume we take the log base 2. Then the log base 2 of 1,000, it's roughly 10. So you get 10 times as many bits per squaring. So sounds like a pretty good deal. Second note, there is a more complicated proof that the S2 mod n generator is secure under the factoring assumption. Here I did only prove it under the quadratic reciprocity assumption. In the original paper, you find a proof showing equivalence to the factoring assumption. So this was the S2 mod n generator. Any questions? So on the next slides, you'll find what I explained to you, that unpredictability to the left is the same as unpredictability to the right, is the same as unpredictability to the middle. Okay, so this is a reminder that I should go. So these next slides, I would say you can read it if you're really interested, but I don't ask you to do, because I have the feeling it's a little bit tricky. And the main message I gave you. So this is a slide I will continue. So in some sense, I told you in prose the results of those slides. If you want to look at them, do it. But I will not ask you anything about it in an examination. So the good thing to remember is all these criteria are equivalent. So in practice, you can choose the criterion which is closest to your need and is closest to what you want to prove. Okay.
So welcome from my side. Mr. Fitzman asked me to do the tutorial again today. So I hope you enjoyed the last one, the last time I did this. And today we will do the rest of 313 and see how how far we will get afterwards. So Mr. Fitzman already said it's okay if I do only the 313, and if you understand the 313 afterwards really, then it's also okay. So are there any questions belonging to the lecture? Hopefully not to the topic that I want. Anything to the lecture? Any questions there? Okay. So, or any questions to the exercises from last time or these things? Okay. So then we can start here. I think you did until the number F. So this was this one. What about the inverse of, so you calculated the inverse of 24 modulo 101 with the extended Euclidean, how's it called? Euclidean algorithm. And now we are asked to do to calculate y mod 77 with y equals 2 modulo 7 and y equals 3 modulo 11. So doing this with the Chinese remainder theorem. So everybody fine with the Chinese remainder theorem? So who thinks who understood the Chinese remainder theorem and how to calculate with these things? So who? We do a preliminary question now, and I ask you the same question afterwards. Who thinks who can calculate this on his own? Okay, we only can get better. Great. Okay, so I write the exercise once more on the blackboard. So we have we want to know why modulo 77, and we have given the y. Say y p is, so no, we say y, it's this y, which equals 2 modulo 7, and the y which equals, oh, where is it? There, 3 modulo 11. So we have to calculate a y modulo 77. So there was the one equation you should have in mind with the Chinese remainder theorem, which helps you every time you have to calculate something. So this is the equation y equals yp times something plus yq times something. And this something here where these two factors, we have them from the extended Euclidean algorithm. And you have to multiply the factors of q to the yp. So here is vq. So, and here where the q is, you have to multiply the p to this times p. So this one. So, and this is the question you have to have in mind for everything. Okay? So if we have this, we only need, because now we already know some parts of this equation. So we want to have this y. We already know this one. We know this one. We know this one. And we know this one. And we know this one. So the only thing what's missing in this equation is the v and the u. So this one we have to calculate, and we get this with the extended Euclidean algorithm. So we can do this very shortly. We do the algorithm with 11 and 7. So, and everybody who wants to, who don't know how to calculate the extended Euclidean algorithm, now wake up and look once more. So it was 11 equals and sometimes 11, so it's 1 times it fits there. And we need 4 in addition, plus 4. So then we take these parts there. So saying 7 equals 1 times 4 plus 3. And 4 equals 1 times 3 plus 1. And in the Euclidean algorithm, we go one step further, which is 3 equals 3 times 1 plus 0. And every time we have the 0 here, we know the number before what was our greatest common divisor. So this was the Euclidean algorithm. So we can do this with every number. And this number was the greatest common divisor, which should be 1 for in our case, because otherwise we cannot calculate, or of course we can do this algorithm with other numbers, but if this number is 1, we can have an inverse and we can use it for these things. So we now take this equation where we have the 1 here, and what's the name of umstellen? I think we need this term very often now. Change? What reorder? Okay, we have to reorder this, saying 1 equals 4 minus 1 dot times 3. So, and this one, now we can take this 3, which is also here, and we can reorder this equation and put it into this equation afterwards. So we have here the 4 minus 1 times, and now we have the 3, and now we can put the reordered question here, equation from here inside my question, which is 7 minus 1 times 4. So, and this one equals, okay, we make every step 4 minus 1 times 7, and then minus 1 times minus 1 is plus 1. Plus 1 times 4. So, and this is minus 1 times 7 plus 2 times 4. Now we take this again and we see we have here the 4 here, which we have in this equation as well. So, and we can reorder this equation as well and put this equation into the other one. So, which means we have 1 equals minus 1 times 7 plus 2 times, and now this equation reordered, 11 minus 1 times 7. So, and this one equals, so we can take first this one with the 11 all parts, is 2 times 11. And then we have minus 1 times 7 plus 2 times minus 1 is minus 2. So minus 1 minus 2 is minus 3. Saying minus 3 times 7. So now the question to all of you who not attended my exercise on Friday. We did now a lot of calculation here, and can we prove that this equation is correct? Yes, if it's equal 1. Yeah, that's it. Just calculate it. So 2 times 11 is 22, and 3 times 7 is minus 21. 22 minus 21 is 1. Yes, it's a very simple question. Yeah. So I've seen that these simple questions, so many of these questions are asked in lectures, not in lectures, in examinations. And you're sitting there and the student was sitting there. And of course, he knows it's a very simple question. And then, yes. Then you have this sound of silence inside. Okay, so and these two are the factors. So we have 11 times 2 and 3 times minus 3. And these are the factors here for this one. So by the way, we use this extended algorithm for calculating the inverse of an element. So for example, if we have 7, we want to calculate the inverse of 7 modulo 11. We had done the same algorithm as well. So now another simple question. How can you see that on this equation, the minus 3 is the inverse to this modulo 11? So maybe you already know, yes, okay, we have to take this number and this is the inverse. But why is this the case? Okay, so because we are in modulo 11, if we calculate the whole thing modulo 11, so this part will go away because it's something times 11, and this part shows minus 3 times 7 equals 1. And the definition of the inverse was 1 equals a times a to the minus 1 if this element is the inverse of a. So, and if we calculate this one modulo, so of course modulo something, and if we calculate this equation modulo 11, so we have exactly this term like it was in the definition. So and from this we know, okay, this has to be the inverse of this element. So in this Zusammenhang, whatever called in English, this helps us as well in within this equation. So we will see in some minutes. I will show you. So, but now, we just can put all these numbers into our equation and can solve it. That's very easy. So we can just take yp, which was, so now we can give the thing names. This is p and this is q. So saying yp is 2 times, and now vq, so we take the 2 and the 11 times 2. So these are these factors coming from the Euclidean algorithm. And then we take yq is 3 times, and then these factors. Okay, so every time in the crossing here, and then we take the factors from here. So now we have just to solve this modulo 77. So this one is 22 times 2, it's 44 plus minus 21 times 3 is 63. This one. And now we can calculate minus 63 modulo 77 is 14. So, and then this is 44 plus 14, which is 58. Once again, easy question. How can we prove that this is correct? Yes. Yes, that's it. So 58 modulo 11 must be 3. So 58 modulo 11 is minus 55. So it's 3. And modulo 7 makes 58 minus 56 is 2. So this was what we required in our what was the task we actually have to do. So therefore, we find a y which is 58 modulo 77, and this y is 2 modulo 7 and 3 modulo 11. So now again, to this, what we had here. So the same trick we had here with the inverse, so that we can take this equation. So this one equals this one. When we take this one modulo 11, we said this term is going away. We have only this term equals one here, which is exactly the definition here. So we can make the same trick with this equation or this one. So if we take this equation and calculate this equation modulo p, means that this part is going away, because here we have the p inside. And in this part, we have here the element times its inverse, modulo p. So here is a 1, which means that here we have only the yp. So if we take the whole equation, we have only yp left, because this is the element times its inverse, and this is going away. If we take the same equation, modulo q, then this will go away. And we have here q times, p times its inverse. And therefore, we have here a 1. And this means if we take the whole equation modulo q, then we have only yq. And there you can see that this equation will work afterwards. Okay? But at the end of the day, as an engineer, what you have to do is just remember this equation. There's the q, and there's the p, and there's the p, and there's the q. Then calculate these cofactors with the extended Euclidean algorithm, and then just put it inside, ready. So who thinks who can calculate this task now on his own? Come on, come on. Who's too lazy now? So, and who wants to calculate the next one? Though this one, do we have another? Yes. Who wants to calculate the set? So I did one. You can do the other. And for this calculation, we can be very lucky, because it's modulo 7 and modulo 11. So we have the same numbers as here, 7 and 11. We can reuse our extended Euclidean algorithm. But if you want to, I can give you other numbers where you can do this Euclidean algorithm as well. Nobody? Come on. Who can do this faster than this melody? Okay. Yes, this one is now very easy, because we have the set, set which equals 6 times. And now we have the modulo 7. So then we have here the 6 modulo 7. And therefore, we have to take now in this equation the other one, so the q. So 6 times 11 times, and the factor of the 11, 2, plus 10 times, and now the other two factors, minus 3 times 7. Modulo 77, and that's it. So this is 22. 22 times 6 is, we can do 22 times 3, which is 66. And 66 modulo 77 is minus 11, times 3 is minus 33. Okay, got this. Plus, this was 21 times 11. And 11 is a prime. Ah, yes, we have 10. Ah, great, great. No prime here. Okay, so then we have here, this was minus 21. And this is 2 times 5. So minus 21 times 5 is 105. 105 modulo 77 is 23, 28. And 28 times 2 is 56. And I think we have minus 56. So, and 56 modulo 77 is 421. Is this correct? So we can look if everything is correct afterwards. So now we have minus 33 plus 21 is minus 12. And now how we could prove this? Well, I think it's not correct. Is it? So we have to do this modulo 11. Yes, modulo 11, it's correct. It's minus 1, it's 11. And modulo 7, it should be 6. And there plus 14, no, it's 2. Okay. Does anyone have the... Yeah? Okay, so here we have 22 times 3 is, what did I calculate it? 22 times 2 is 44. Now we take times 3 is 66. 66 modulo 11 is minus 11. Yes, why not? No, times 2 is 22. This one. Great. So, and this means it is minus 1. Okay? Yes, of course. Then, wasn't this stupid? Okay, it's of course minus 1, because minus 1 modulo 7 is 6, and minus 1 modulo 11 is 10. Okay, so questions to the the Chinese remainder algorithm or Chinese remainder theorem? So we do this afterwards once more when we come to the quadratic residue things. Okay? So then task H. Test if the following residue classes are quadratic residues, in parentheses, calculating with the negative representatives of the residue classes simplifies your work. So, and we have 13 modulo 19, 2 modulo 23, and minus 1 modulo 89. So I just write the numbers. So first we test if these are quadratic residues. So how can we test this? So we had another formula given in the lecture, which said, which can calculate the Jacobi symbol or the Legendre symbol. And this Legendre symbol said, if it's one, if for a number A, the Legendre symbol equals one, so you wrote it this way, A over P. So if this is one, then it's A in this class, and so this was the Legendre symbol, and then you had a formula with which you can calculate this Legendre symbol, and this formula was A over P is A to the P minus 1 half modulo P. And with this, you can calculate the Legendre symbol. Okay? Yes, and with this, it's very easy. Because we can just do the calculation here. Saying A is 13 to the 19 minus 1 half. So this is 13, 19 minus 1 is 18, 18 half is 9 to the 9. Now we just have to calculate this. So how to calculate this? Yeah. So 9 in decimal is 1001 binary. So and then we can say 13 to the 1 equals 13. Then we shift ones. 13 to the 1, 0. So now when you try to remember while you're doing this algorithm, in this first step, it's every time the same, the first step. So 1, 0, do I have to multiply now or do I have to square now? Yes, so this is a 2, so 13 squared must be a square. So shifting is squaring, so meaning we have to calculate now 13 square, which is 13 modulo 19 is minus 6. This is 36. Modulo 19 is 11, 17. So then 13 and 1 0 shifted again. So means is 17 squared, because here we have now a 4 in decimal, decimal. And this is a 2, so this has to be the squared of the previous one. So 17 squared is the same as minus 2 squared. Is 4, and now we calculate 13, shift once more, which is 4 square, which is 16, and now we have 1001. Now we flip the bit, which means we have to multiply this, and this is the previous value times the base value. And this was equal to minus 3, and this is equal to minus 6. And this is 18. Okay. Now we have a problem, because this is neither equal minus 1 nor 1. What should we do? Come on. When I what? Yes, yes, of course, it's equal minus one. Yes, I just wanted you to wake up. Okay, so what was the meaning of the minus one? Yes, it's not in the quadratic residue, and this is what we calculated there. Okay? So we got it. The next number is 2 to the 23 minus 1 divided by 2, which equals 2 to the 22 divided by 2 is times 11. So, and this one is 2048. Now let's calculate this modulo 23. No, of course we want to do this one. 11 equals 1011. So this is 38, yes. So and to the 1 is 2. 1010 is 4. 100 is 6. Wait. It's 4 squared. So 4 squared is 16. 101 is 16 times 2. And we are in which modulo? Modulo 23. Okay. In modulo 23, we have 7 minus 7 times 2 is minus 14. And 2 to the 1010 is 1010, the previous one squared, and minus 16 modulo 23 is 69. Is 81, and this modulo 23 is 12, and this one is 12 times 2 is 24 is 1, or we have to write. Great. And again, we proved it's in the quadratic residue, as we have done here. So, and the last thing is minus 1 to the 8, 9 minus 1 half. It's minus 1 to the 44. And what is this? Okay, 44 in binary notation. Yes, it's 1. Of course. Okay, and in this last equation, of course, you see every time the minus 1 is every time a quadratic residue when you have this equation is the even number. Okay, and then we have to do something else because if yes and if the simple algorithm from the script is applicable, extract the root. So what was the simple algorithm from the script? So we have something something like this. Nobody can remember? Come on, you can remember.
it's here.
Yeah, that's the algorithm. So, and we cannot do this for every P. So, but only for P's, what was the assumption on P, or the not assumption, so there's a condition on P. So, P modulo 4 has to equal 3. Okay, because if we want to do this in this one, we have here, yes, so we can just test this. So we have these two candidates, the 2 modulo 23, 23 modulo 4 is 3, and this one, 89 modulo 4 is minus 88 is 1. So this one shouldn't work. And if we would try to do this algorithm with it, we had to calculate 89 plus 1 divided by 4. So 89 is 90, divided by 2 is 45. And this one we cannot divide by 2 anymore. So there we see, okay, there has to be anything we have to restrict. Okay, but now we can do this. Should also be not very hard. So here we calculate the extract the root of 2 modulo 23. And this is 2 to the 23 plus 1 divided by 4. And this is 24 divided by 4. Is 6, and 2 to the 6 is 64, and 64 modulo 23 is minus 2 or 21. Is this correct? How can you test if this is correct? Once again, think about what we have done now. How can we test if this root is correct, this calculation? Yes, we do the square. So this one squared should be 2, if we are correct, modulo 23. So this is the same as minus 2. And minus 2 squared is 4. Minus 4 plus 23. No, that seems not to be correct. This was wrong. This is 23 times 3 is 69. And 69, no, did I? Is, yes, it's 69. It's minus 5, yes. It's minus 5, and this is 18. So now again, 18 is minus 5, as I said, and minus 5 squared is 25, and 25 modulo 23 is 2. Seems to be correct. So is this the only root, or do we have another root? So we have only calculated the 18 now. Come on, wake up, wake up. It's not so hard. Yes, it's minus 18. So we have plus minus 18. Because the negative squared is, of course, the same number as the positive squared. Okay? But keep this in mind. Every root calculated in a prime number modulo has two, no, every number has two roots in a, if you calculate in some class where you have a prime number, modulo some prime number. So, and of course, we have every time two roots because this was exactly what we have done here in this calculation. One of them has the minus one and one of them has the one. And this was the meaning one of them again has a root and one has no root. So if you draw a picture of this, you have here some number and you extract the root from this. And extracting the root, you have two numbers. And from one of the number, you can extract again two roots.